So, hi, I'm Carrie, I'm an alcoholic. I just want to thank you all. I mean, I've had a wonderful weekend. Sometimes doing this stuff could be really emotionally and spiritually exhausting. As I'm sure some of the people in this room know. But I actually have had so much fun. It doesn't feel like work at all, because you guys are pretty awesome. I've actually learned stuff, you know, that I was like, wow, I didn't know that. That is so cool. I'm totally stealing that. and I feel like you guys have been a wonderful, wonderful crowd. I feel like, you know, you all brought some pretty awakened spirits here. And I want to thank you all for allowing me to participate in your weekend and for allowing me to participate in your recovery. And for that, I'm very, very, very grateful. And I'm grateful for Mike for inviting me out here and probably lobbying and saying, I promise you won't see anything too filthy. I told her to behave herself. I'm kidding. I just want to thank you all. And it's such a privilege to serve Alcoholics Anonymous. And more than anything else, it's such a privilege to serve Alcoholics Anonymous and be able to spend some time with people that I truly respect and love. And I want to thank you for that. I had a couple questions. I actually had a question that I thought I had answered it face-to-face, but I thought it might be pretty relevant to kind of start off this session. Somebody asked me, they said, well, you know, when I did some inventory with somebody a week ago, and we did this piece of inventory with resentment and fear, and they're still really angry. They're still really resentful. What do? Do I put them back into the fear prayer? Do I put them back into the resentment prayer? What do we do? And in the conversation with this individual, I asked, I said, well, what did their fear inventory look like? And he was like, well, you know, I have a couple fears. And I said, well, you know, you might want to take a look at that. And they were kind of talking about how Bill wasn't, and then again, I'm blessed with like this mind that like is completely non-functional in certain ways and very, 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 very quick and makes connections. Like that's kind of how my brain works. Like I'm for whatever reason, I'm able to see connections and patterns and things like that in a pretty easy way. So when I read the big book and I see something going on, I say, well, you know, obviously Bill didn't put this, or the first 100 alcoholics didn't put this for an arbitrary reason. So why is this the way it is? And we're talking about how the inventories are structured. Like, why do we start with resentment? Why is it, you know, the first inventory resentment? And it's like, well, mostly, because, you know, no offense to alcoholics, or we're sort of resentful type people. And talking about who we're pissed off at is pretty easy. You know, I mean, because I had a list. You know, I'd be sitting in the bar with the list of all the people who, you know, basically pissed me off and made it so that I had to sit in the bar. And that list is, like, ready at our hand. But the other part of that is that for me, and in my experience, it's been that you can't have resentment without fear. That the reality of the situation is that my resentment is actually fear masquerading as something else. And in the process of writing this resentment inventory, I really begin to see that. So that's why fear is in the middle. Because the fear inventory really kind of resolves the resentment. You can write the resentment inventory and still be pretty gosh darn pissed off. And then you write that fear inventory and you realize, like, I'm not really hurt, I'm not really angry. What I really am is afraid, or hurt, threatened, and interfered with. Or, you know, I fear that I'm unworthy of love. I fear that this will happen again. And you begin to see that what's really going on here is not so much that I resent the individual that I wrote down on the paper, but fear is driving me. You know, I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-pity. And then we write our conduct inventory. And if you ever notice, the conduct inventory, it doesn't massage anything. It doesn't say, well, what did that person do in that relationship? That conduct inventory says, what did you do? Were you a bastard? And what should you have done instead? There's no loop whatsoever in the conduct inventory, because if you write your resentment inventory first, and then you do this fear inventory, and you do it well, and then you do your sex and harms or conduct inventory, by that point, we recognize and make those emotional and spiritual connections with lack of faith, fear, self-reliance. So when you say you can write an magnum opus resentment inventory, But if you shortchange your fear inventory, you're going to be writing another magnum opus of a resentment inventory. And I don't know about you, and who are some of the old dogs in the room? Like people who have been sober for an extended period of time. How much resentment inventory do you actually write at this point? How much fear inventory do you write?
Yeah,
and honestly, as you evolve, as you grow in this path, it's not that I don't get resentful, but my spirit doesn't buy the bullshit that my mind tells it in regards to this resentment. I get resentful and I realize I'm not really resentful. What I really am is afraid. What is the core of this specific issue in my life? So as you do this work, your resentment inventory will get smaller.
Carrie, what is your best whatever about? Is there a third column of your inventory, or is there not?
There is. Well, it depends on how you write it. I wish Bill had drawn pictures. Like when I rewrite the big book one day. And I'm the second coming of Bill Wilson. I would, because I realize that we're all IKEA people. That's why I call it an IKEA inventory. I look at the picture and I don't read the book. we're all IKEA people, meaning that we just like to look at the picture and put tab A and slot B, and we don't bother going into the text. But I actually sat with somebody yesterday and kind of pointed out, it's not so much that there's columns, but there's questions in the fear inventory. And if you look at it on page 67, the last paragraph on the page, it says, notice the word fear is bracketed along the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mr. Jones, and the employer and the wife. So that whole connecting my third column with fear, we didn't make that up. It's actually in the picture. It doesn't actually say that in the text. And that's why I said, love Bill, you know, if I could do that, I probably would make some prettier pictures and a little clearer, because, you know, we like to twist things and I don't like to give my ego or my alcoholism any room. But, so it says that. So, you know, we're connecting the fear with our third column. This short word touches every aspect of our lives. It is the evil and corroded thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it, meaning that our fears touch every area of our life. They do and they will. Fear is like a bowl of fish hooks. If you put your hand in, you're not taking out just one. You know, you're taking out a whole pile of fear, which is why it has so much power, guys. Why does fear have so much power in our lives? Because the one thing is, when you are in untreated alcoholism, you are absolutely mastered by fear. Why? Because one fear begets another fear, 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 begets another fear. So I think I'm afraid that you're not going to like me, but I really am afraid that I'm an unworthy, not good enough, going to die an alcoholic death, and God doesn't love me neither.
And the more I try to fix myself, the more frightened I become.
Exactly. Exactly. You're absolutely right on that.
Because we're really writing this to disclose the fact, not to find out information so I can work on myself or fix myself, is to convince myself of the utter impossibility of me fixing myself.
Yeah.
It's not, oh, I see what I did wrong, I'll never do that again.
Nope.
Well, maybe, but it'll show up in drag somewhere else.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Which is why the seventh step doesn't say, continue to work on my character defects. Nowhere in the sixth and seventh step does it tell us that we're to work on our character defects. We're to ask for the willingness to have them removed. Nowhere does it say, like, well, I'll just work on that. Because that's like, you know, that's an impossibility. My sick mind can't fix my sick mind. Lack of power is my dilemma. But when it comes to fear, it says it's set in trained circumstances which brought us misfortune, which we felt we didn't deserve. We felt we were the victim. And I love that it says brought and trained, because it means that, yeah, it's kind of like this. It's like a domino effect. Bless you. You know, I have a fear, I respond to the fear, I act in accordance with what that fear dictates for me. I start doing things by doing things. I create circumstances that completely go beyond my ability to fix, manage, and control whatever situation that triggered the fear in the first place. So I'm afraid I acted a certain way, then you respond to me, and then this responds to that, and all of a sudden, it's gotten, like, it's a forest fire. It's gotten way out of hand. So when it says set and train circumstances, it means that it's like that tipping point, that thing that sets off the rest of the other stuff that's going to happen. And it says, but do not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Good question. Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. And then it goes on to say, Bill, and as I said, Bill kind of did it a little bit out of order. I kind of just, ever so slightly, because my brain is kind of crazy, rearrange these sentences. So bear with me and please forgive my complete and utter,
Harris.
Yes, thank you. I was trying to look for the right word for it, but that's exactly what it is. Says, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment with them. So I look at that as being, is column one or question one. A lot of times, like I said, guys, I don't use columns anymore. What I actually do is question one, line, and I write it. Because columns means that I'm actually, my brain looks at that and says, well, I can only put enough information that falls in that little column. And no offense, but I'm way more effed up than that. I need a page sometimes. You know, so my brain makes more sense and more space. You do it however you want. Like columns, whatever, that stuff is window dressing. It's really the meat and potatoes of these questions that matter. And Tom Ivester taught me that because I did a workshop with him when I was, oh my God, I was like 26, and I was like crazy on fire, big book, young newcomer, had about 8 years and was like frothing at the mouth, you know, more than this. This is me being good. This is years of refinement. So can you imagine what I was like when I was 25, 26? And you know, we had all the big book gerbils, I call us, you know, in our little cage, like reading our book, making stuff up, right? So we all go to this conference in Philadelphia, and Sandy and Tom are presenting, and I had to do a presentation on the fourth step, right? And so I'm in the columns. It has to be columns, and it has to be this, and it's that, and you know, and I'm like, you know, going nuts about columns in a four step's not a four step if you didn't write it. And I'm like, and it isn't, but I'm like frothing at the mouth. And from the podium, cause that's, I love that man. he goes, hey, Carrie, by the way, I wrote my four step in jail on toilet paper. I couldn't use columns. I was like, oh, man! Okay. Because what he was really trying to say is that it's the spirit and the meat and potatoes of these questions. You can write your four step on a piece of toilet paper in prison, I guess, if you would like to. If you feel you need to. It really doesn't matter. What matters is how am I answering these questions? So it says, you know, this first column, we put them on paper, though we had no resentment with them. So we list our fears with resentment. We list our fears that have no resentment with them. Second question, we ask ourselves why we have them. That's that boil down that I showed you. Why do I have that fear? And so what you do is you say, why do I have that fear? And then you come up with the next fear. You go, why did I have that fear? Come up with the next fear. Why did I have that fear? Come up with the next fear. Because what we're doing is we're looking for areas in which, or ideas or beliefs or fears that we have that tell us that, you know, God is not going to be involved in that specific area. And that's really what we're looking for. We're looking for the areas in which we're still keeping God out or not inviting him, he, she, or it in. Then we go back to that sentence that preceded it and said, Did we ourselves set the ball rolling? And it comes into this next question, which comes back, says, was it because self-reliance failed us? So I kind of take those two questions and say, how did I set the ball rolling with this fear? So, for example, my fear of rejection is less about you actually rejecting me and more about me needing your approval for me to feel safe, happy, and okay. Which connects me back to the third column of my fourth step. Then I said that when those seven areas of self, when they're hurt, threatened, and interfered with, or when you're not giving me what I want in those areas, I become afraid. Which is why in the picture, fear is bracketed in the third column of the fourth step. Because Bill wants us to realize that That's where the linchpin of my spiritual sickness lies. Not in the resentment, not where I put my wiener, but in what my mind tells me about myself and you. Now, the resentment and all that other stuff, what I steal from you, what I do in that other area and those other areas are connected to that linchpin of fear. But it's fear that's the drivetrain of all of this. So, I say, how did I set the ball rolling? How is that? So the real question is, how does that connect to my resentment inventory? And was it because self-reliance failed me? And that's it. Because that's a question we all miss, man. We're all like, oh, like my inner child is naughty and I do naughty things. And yeah, I got some information, but we miss the question. Was this fear and all of the stuff that I just wrote down and all of the things I just described because self-reliance failed me? So the real question Bill's asking us is, how's that working for you? That's really what I say is, how's that working? And so some people answer that a yes or no. I don't. I answer that a, was it because, yes, how? How is self-reliance failing me in this area? I add that one word. And for me, it makes a difference because it paints me a picture. So my self-reliance in, I will not rely on an ephemeral belief in God and that I'm a child of God, even though I sort of believe it, but I don't. I won't rely on that. Instead, I'll use you to prop up my ego so that I can be okay, except for when I don't or when you don't like me. I feel like I'm not okay, and therefore self-reliance is failing me because I'm using human power to do for me what I should be going to God for. And for me, I need to write that out. And that's because I'm hard-headed, and I need to see that on paper. I need to see that human power fails me. Some people answer it a yes or no. Some people it's a rhetorical question. I like to write that out. So that's really, that's a personal flavor. And then it has us the next question. It goes on to say self-reliance was good as far as it went. Explain why it's good, meaning that like if you're stuck in the middle of the woods, it's probably good that you should try and like get out and eat berries or whatever it is. Like we don't sit there and wait for the helicopter or God to come and rescue us. We take action, right? So it, but it says that it doesn't fully solve the fear problem. And when it made us cocky, it was worse. Never mind. It says, perhaps there's a better way. And that's the next question. So that's kind of the questions of the inventory. How you write that or how you structure that is really kind of up to you. That make sense to you?
Yes, thank you.
You know. And perhaps, by the way, when we said this yesterday, that is going to be the, that is going to be your relationship ideal. I like to use the word relationship ideal instead of sex ideal. Because sex ideal conjures all kinds of things that a relationship ideal doesn't. When I say it's a relationship ideal, it's about my relationship with myself and you.
It's about who I'm going to be, not who they need to be.
Exactly, 6 foot tall, blue eyes, a really fat wallet. That was my sex ideal. My relationship ideal is very, very different. But I have grown since the first time I wrote that. I assure you, Tom. The first time I wrote a sex ideal, I walked up to my husband and said, "You're not any of those things. You better fix that." And then my sponsor said, "Bad Carrie! Bad Carrie! This is not a list of demands! And you wrote it wrong!" Not that any of the women in this room identify with that at all. You ever accidentally leave your relationship out, ideal out just so that he could peruse it so you could passive aggressively tell him what he's not doing? Am I giving you ideas now? Okay. So do you kind of feel like in terms of the fear inventory and also how the inventories are structured and why we start with resentment, why the middle of this inventory is fear, and why the conduct or sex harm inventory is really just to the point and all meat and no potatoes? Kind of getting that? Well, and that kind of helps us when we find somebody and we say, okay, if I do resentment inventory but I'm still resentful, where am I stuck? And we kind of, Tracy illustrated that perfectly yesterday, God bless his soul, that we can have a lot of information in terms of our conduct and our behavior in our resentment inventory, but if there's a deeper fear that maybe we're, maybe like didn't know because we didn't even know to look, because how do you know what you don't know? You don't know until somebody asks you a question in front of a room full of people that's really personal. And then you go, oh, not kidding. But you can look at it and say, wow, like, I thought I was afraid of this, but what I really was afraid of was this. And when you kind of get to that gut level fear, you can do some inventory on that, and you'll find that the resentment itself will lose steam and power. Is this making sense to you guys? And a last comment in regards to the piecemeal inventory, fist-stepping slash inventory process that I do with newcomers. It does, the impact of sitting for 12 hours and spewing your guts is tremendous, and it does diminish that. It really does. I don't suggest doing the one inventory at a time kind of fist step for everybody or for people who have already been through the work, because now you're coddling them and they're just using you to make them rub their tummy while they're writing inventory. But for me, I get a lot of people who have like 15 days, 30 days, and they're racked up. They're racked up, twitchy, smelly still. They're not sleeping. And I also know, and it's kind of like, maybe you guys don't have this, but I kind of have this theory of get them quick, get them fast before the rest of AA ruins their recovery. So, because what'll happen is, like, I'm telling them, you need to do this work, and then they go into a meeting and somebody said, well, I've been sober 37 years, and I have yet to write a four-step, but I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really happy, except for my wife doesn't speak to me, and my children hate me, but, you don't have to drink today, you're a winner. And then they come back to me and they're like, but Carrie, look, man, I could be like this guy, and I think, well, yeah, do you want that guy's life? But sometimes, in alcoholics were, especially early on in recovery, we're scared. And you give us any excuse not to do what we gotta do, and we're gonna take it. So, by virtue of that, if I get you in my kitchen, you leave on your four step. That's it. Like, I don't care how long it takes. If it has to be a 15-minute conversation, I'm gonna do that. I'm gonna also send you away with a handful of tapes, usually Don and Joe and Bob and Gary, because I'm like, okay, listen to this while you're writing your four step. And it kind of builds up kind of what I've already had that conversation for or with. So a lot of times I'm getting people through steps 1, 2, and 3 in a matter of an hour to 3 hours of Dr. Bob style. And they're on their four step when they leave my house. So they're still shaky, and cognitively they're a mess. They can barely write or read half the time. So helping them write their inventory, having them make a list is pretty easy. Writing down names is pretty easy for them to do from a cognitive perspective, in terms of with detox and early recovery, and the MOCUS is the word I use. So it's a lot easier to have them do that, because I feel like if I waited for their brains to clear up for them to be able to write inventory effectively, probably Dark Tunnel AA will have kidnapped them and stolen them from me. And since I'm a hostage taker in terms of my sponsee, I'm very protective of them. As Mike likes to point out, okay, that I take hostages, not sponsees. I'm kidding. I really am. But I just find that to be easier. If you're in an area where people, that is not necessarily the case, you don't necessarily have to do it the way that I do it. But just in terms of triage, get her done, get them fasting before AA ruins their recovery. That's really what I try to do. So that's kind of why it'll take people about 3 weeks to finish their inventory and be done with their fifth step and leave on their amends. And sometimes I just take them hostage for a weekend and we do it in a matter of 3 days. There have been times when people were so physically ill, and they were like, and a lot of times these are also not people who have never been in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're people who have been and relapsed and been around, or alkanauts who don't really know the recovery process. And they keep saying AA doesn't work, and I really want them to get a taste of how AA really does work. So those are the, those people are the people that I will take when they're off a bender, take them to my house, feed them, and get them through the steps in a matter of 3 days, or 2 days, or 1 day even for that matter. And so it kind of depends. You know, so I hope that, you know, me talking about the different ways that I do or have done the fifth step and different reasons or ways that it works in terms of, the bottom line is I try to meet the person where they are at. So I've had people who were so sick but really, really, really truly wanted this, where I wrote their fourth step for them because they couldn't write. Their hands were shaking so badly. Booze is a nasty bastard, man. Like, in terms of what it physically does to you, is horrible. So I had people who could read, could talk, but they couldn't write. And they were people who, like, you know, if they had any time away from the bottle, they were right back to the bottle. I have friends who would leave treatment or leave detox and be high or drunk before they even got home. I have friends who smuggled stuff in. I've got stories of that stuff. So when you kind of think about it, say, well, send somebody to detox, and then, you know, when they come out, you can meander through the steps. And there's some hardcore low-bottom people who don't have that time or that grace. And they need to be gotten to, and they need to be gotten to yesterday. And with somebody like that, you know, if they're too shaky to write their inventory, dictate. You write it. You know? We meet people where they're at. Do you think Dr. Bob said to the guy who was shaky, you know, with 2 days at, you know, like abstinent from alcohol, you know, well, you know what? Your withdrawals are too hard, too difficult for you to be able to write in a prolonged inventory. So, you know, I'll get you next week. Do you think those guys said that? No. He took you upstairs, and I think it was Henrietta Cyberling's house, shook the Bible at you, made you hit your knees. Twit, I don't know what he did, snakes and all kinds of things, and you came out and you were like cured and you went and go knocked on some doors, you know? That's the way they did it in the old days. Now, we have learned much, absolutely. More has been revealed. But sometimes the oldies are really goodies. So please don't be so rigid with how you do this. The bottom line is we want people to have the experience. The experience is in this book. We say next, we say launch, we say these things, we have time frames, yes.
So how does the first step for the first year fit into that?
Oh, it doesn't. Absolutely not. Well, what was that? You're not even on step zero when you're on the first step for the first year. So is that making that what I was talking about yesterday in terms of fifth steps, how to write them, how to write inventory, how we can accommodate? Does that kind of make sense to you guys now? Okay. You know, because I certainly didn't want to shoot anybody any bail or give you any excuses to say, what? I don't feel like writing my inventory, so I'll make my sponsor write it. But I also don't want to see us say, well, you can't write inventory, so why don't you go die an alcoholic death until you can? You need to be smart about this. So, who here's got a really cool amends story?
We're talking in here.
Who here's got a really cool amends story?
Right. Amends. My name is Tom. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
We warned us yesterday. I just recently, I'm in a committed relationship and have been for about 3 years. And her best friend, during that 3 years, moved out from the kitchen window that they had for 30 some odd years as best friends. All of a sudden dropped everything and moved to Sun City, Florida. Her husband never retired either. Mm-hmm. And I met him and apparently made a very poor impression on him. Now, he's an alcoholic. He's in recovery. He's got 20 years. He doesn't go to meetings. And I discovered that if you're not in the fellowship, then you have some strange ways about you. It turns out that when we first met, I said something or other, and he misinterpreted what happened, mm-hmm. and then reported back to her. He slandered me, actually. That I was just a chaser and looking for a piece of ass and so forth and so on. I used to be like that. I actually got over that before I got to AA. But, you know, I never had an adolescence, so I had a mental essence when I was in my mm-hmm. career. That's between marriages, and I won't go into that. So I had some resentments around it, and yet we were going down there last winter,
She was going to stay a few days with them while I went on down to where I stay in South Florida. And I thought, well, you know, I really have a resentment here against this guy for slandering me online, because I don't think the way he quoted me is saying. I just don't. I knew I was going to kill him. So I was going back up to pick her up, and I thought, you know, I'm going to confront him on this and just say, what's going on? You know, I called in the program, even though he doesn't go to meetings anymore. And I said, no, that's the wrong way to go. So what I did was, the two ladies ran off together as they do their girlfriends. And so I'm sitting there in his office in his home, and I said, I owe you an amends. I said, I misinterpreted you. He was in the shoe business, retail shoes. And his father had started the company. And I thought he was a typical second-generation person, because I worked with self-employed people as their financial advisor. Mm-hmm. And so I had him all set in the role of dad hand in the business. He got to go play golf every afternoon after he chewed out his employees, things like that. And it turned out that wasn't the case at all, and I found that out recently. That he actually ran into a situation where his dad got in a second marriage after mom died, and he wound up being disinherited. And he took the company, and without any capital, turned it around and rebuilt it better than ever. I just found out a few weeks before this meeting. So I told him, I said, I have an amend to make with you. And I said, I misjudged you completely. And I found out I was Ted Rupp. And I'm sorry for that. And you're a very successful businessman. I admire you. Well, that set the whole situation all the way around. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he didn't reverse anything he says I said, which I'm sure I didn't, because I don't think that way. Nevertheless, we were able to be civil with each other. Mm-hmm. And our ladies are, you know, they're going to be close friends for the rest of their lives, even though they're separated by 1,000 miles now. And that was just pure God working in my life, my higher power, saying, you know, don't confront him, and you'll just fight. You can't win and he can't win. Mm-hmm. And I do respect him for what he's doing in retirement. He's still working with alcoholics. He just doesn't do it the way we do. Mm-hmm. So that's my story.
Thank you.
Nan?
Nan Greco, alcoholic.
Make sure it's getting recorded. I'm just going to kind of take this from a different perspective, because I'll be forever grateful to my first sponsor for the follow-through on amends. But back during the lost years, I was working, doesn't even really matter where, but the desk at which I worked, I had convinced them that I could get so much more done if I came in at night, you know, when everybody else was gone. Of course, so I could be drunk and using at the desk and no one would see me. And I was smoking in the office, of course I wasn't supposed to be. And I burned a hole in the desk, which of course I tried to cover it up, this beautiful oak desk. And the next day, came in, and the guy whose desk is John goes, were you smoking in here last night? Burned the hole in the desk? I went, hole in the desk? What? I'm like, oh my God, that's terrible. So it's probably the maintenance guy. I have no idea who could have done, you know, I was just shocked. So, okay, completely forgot about this. He was never on my resentment list, never on the amends list or anything. And I'm working at a restaurant in Broad Ripple, and it's a lunch shift, and this, I'm a couple years sober, and it's in my, and I'm walking out to the booth, my very first customer, and there he's sitting. Okay, with another guy, and I was like, oh my God! And of course, I immediately go, oh my God, the desk, you know. So I go back, and I'm praying about it, going, what do I do? He's a customer, I'll wait till the other guy leaves, goes to the bathroom or something. Okay, I can do this. So I'm John, Nino, oh great, you know, how are you? We're waiting, and the other guy just never leaves the table. So I'm bringing the check, and I finally lean over, and I look at the other guy and went, I am so sorry. John, I just got back from rehab, and I'm a recovered alcoholic and crack addict. And remember that desk in the office? I get that far, and the other guy goes, I'll be right back. And gets in the yeah. And I said, and I burned, I'm the one to burn the hole in the desk. Of course, he's looking at me like, really? And he said, I'm just so glad you're okay. I said, no, I really need to take care of this and give you some money to pay for the repairs. He's like, no, just the fact that you claim sober, that's plenty. I'm like, are you sure? He's like, yeah. I'm like, well, thank you so much. And I'm so excited. So I called my sponsor and tell her, and she went, no, you owe him. But he said, I don't. She goes, I don't care what he said. In this case, we make amends. I'm like, so I didn't really try to find him. Of course, I told myself I couldn't because I didn't know where he was. And this really hits the made amends wherever possible. Mm-hmm. Years is probably 6 years later. I'm working in a store with a girlfriend of mine. I look up and he walks in the door with his wife. And I went, oh, whoa, John, oh my God, wait a minute. And he's like, and I run to the back and I grab my checkbook and I write out this check like for $200. And I rip it off and I run you back and I said, I really need to take care of this, Destiny. No, I told you before. I said, no, this is something I really have to do. God. You need to let me do this. He's like, well, okay. And I hand him the check. He goes, oh, that's way too much. I went, well, how much? He said, no more than 50. I went, don't move. I rip up that check. I run back to the office. Get my checkbook. I write this other check, you know, and I go, and I'm feeling, and I'm understanding now, because now I'm feeling that relief. Yeah. Really doesn't want to take it, but he takes the check. Okay. Like, great, okay. 6 months later, he hasn't cashed it.
I am.
9 months later, he hasn't cashed it, so I realize he's not going to. Talk to my sponsor. I said, but, you know, I did the right thing. She went, no. And I went, what do you mean, no? She goes, you still owe. Somehow, she goes, and if he won't take it, then you find someone that needs that, or you donate it to some place, but you don't take a tax deduction for it. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? So, but I went ahead and did that, but until I did that, the difference.
Yes.
In how I felt, I was just like, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
And I'm just getting shivers now thinking about that. But had she not, you know, kept saying, you know, I was like, no, this is what, you know, that. And so I completed that. So anyway, just a little different twist there.
But when you talk about cash register amends, you know, I paid back my parents for 17 years. 17 years I gave them. It was either a $50 or a $25 check. Now, this was for, like, not only stolen property, but it was also for them paying for the broken property and the multiple private schools that they paid for me to go to and then which I was expelled on top of the many, many deductibles for the many, many stays in treatment in which I was in treatment 9 times. And, of course, the therapists, you know, because I lied. Like, I just went to therapists to get more stuff. You know, like, it was like the physician's desk reference in the DSM-IV were my best friends at the time. You know, they were my big book of the day. So I used my parents to fund my alcoholism. And that was something I really had to take a look at. So in the amends, it wasn't just the jewelry I stole. It wasn't just the booze I stole. It wasn't just the stuff in the house I broke. But the fact that I took their money and I used it to fund my alcoholism. So 17 years it took me of writing checks to pay them back. And half of them they probably didn't cash. They would cash every now and again. But I kept that tally and I kept writing that check and kept writing that check. And then I realized that they weren't cashing. I did exactly what you did, man. I was like, finally, I was like, so they get a check that they don't cash? I swear to God, this is how it worked. That I would send them a check that I knew that they wouldn't cash. And then I would donate money or give the money to something or somebody donate it to General Service. I would buy big books and give them out. Because I knew they weren't going to cash it, but I also knew that if I stopped sending them checks before the agreed time in the amends, that they would think something was wrong. So I had to send out 2 checks. And then I would have to budget just in case, because every once in a while they would cash it just to make me think that they were cashing my checks. Because, like, every once in a while, my mom would be like, all right, I'll humor her. I'll cash that check. Oh, God, why does she keep doing this? So, yeah, so then I had a budget. So then it was like, I would have to be like, okay, well, if both checks are cashed, that was some interesting bookkeeping. But I'm an alcoholic, so being interesting bookkeeping is what I do.
It'll probably carry.
Okay.
But what, how are we winning this one? Rufus Brown, alcoholic drug addict.
Hey, Rufus.
And, My family kind of knew I was, you know, maybe an alcoholic, but they really thought I was a workaholic. They certainly didn't know I was a raging drug addict, too. And my oldest daughter, because we were very, I had grown up poor, and so I was kind of her idol of, mm-hmm. you know, pull yourself by the bootstraps, et cetera, et cetera. And when she went away to undergraduate school, I was on a run where you turn off your phone and you're gone for a few days. And I ran out of money, so I came home and I took the Nissan Sentra, the new car I just bought her, and I sold it for drugs. And 3 days later, that car was used in a bank robbery. So the police show up at my house, not there. And they're wondering, well, Mrs. Brown, my now ex-wife, how is your car being used in a bank robbery? So, kind of the secret got, I mean, it wasn't a secret, but when my daughter found out that her father was a drug addict and had taken her car and sold it, It just destroyed her.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it just totally, totally devastated her. Yeah. And so years later, when I tried to make my amends to her, she basically told me where to go. Mm. And she was not interested in hearing anything from me about anything and sorry and all that. So then it was my turn to be devastated. But, you know, of course, my sponsor says, you know, she may never come around. It's not your business. It's not mm-hmm. your job. And your job is to do the best you can. And then she came home to visit. And sometimes she stayed with the mom, sometimes she stayed with... She happened to be her my Father's Day, and I was giving a talk somewhere, and she was here. She went with me, but I came down into the kitchen that Father's Day morning, and on the counter was a card. Mm-hmm. And the card, she says, "What I give you for Father's Day is my forgiveness." She says, "I now know that what happened was not about me." She took it personal.
Yeah.
And it was about you and what you had to go through and what you had to do. And today we are very best friends. She's also happens to be a Harvard Law School graduate and does all kind of wonderful stuff. But we are absolutely the best of friends. Not father-daughter. We're just the best. She's my best friend ever. Mm-hmm. And just that turnaround... I mean, nobody has to tell me about the power of God in this business, because I can feel it. Mm-hmm. I'm done.
Okay.
Wow. Thank
you. Good. You're back here. Yeah, you can hold it.
My name's Daryl. I'm an alcoholic. My mother was she's been dead now 11 or 12 years, and she's a manic depressive alcoholic. And as a kid, I didn't understand the disease of alcoholism, so I was kind of in one or two modes where that was concerned. I was either the victim, or there were times where I was the assassin, where that relationship was concerned. So I had written Graveside Amends, and my wife Tracy and I had gone to the gravesite, and I read this letter to my mother, and I just didn't feel... I didn't feel anything. I just felt like there was something that was undone, and I was discouraged and kind of confused by that. So I was talking to Tracy about it, and so why don't you go pray about it? And in my mind, I'm thinking, great, one more person telling me to go pray about it. So I went and did that, and I started getting these images of newcomers coming to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, so I have a heart for newcomers, and I'm always eager to go meet them and make sure they don't leave without me saying hello to them. I was puzzled by that, and I thought, why in the heck am I thinking about that? I can't even come over here and pray about the situation with my mom about thinking about myself. And so that was confusing to me. And all of a sudden, I saw my mother, an image of my mother as a young woman, standing in the door of the club that I go to regularly in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And we stood and looked at one another. And I knew at that point I had a choice to make. So I was able to walk up and welcome her and hug her. And I knew at that moment we forgave one another. And it's a situation just not really knowing, you know, and instantly I was freed from the things that had been going on, and Rufa, which you often talk about forgiveness being being able to act as if it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until that moment that I was able to feel as if it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And then there was another time when Carrie, you mentioned about, you know, how free do you want to be? And I was listening to a Mark Houston tape, and I went into Walmart one night, and there were some things that in my conduct that I wasn't sure how I was ever going to get squared away. And, you know, treating people poorly that I may never see again, saying things that were mean or offensive. And I remember being with some friends and saying some offensive things to a young black man. And, you know, I never knew, how am I going to reconcile some of that? So I'm walking through and I see a young guy, you know, cleaning up, and I didn't think much about it. And I put my buds on and listened to my iPod and some tapes as I was walking through doing stuff. And as I'm walking out there again, he says, "Well, how free do you want to be?" And I said, "You got to be kidding me." So I turn around, and that gentleman was about here to that wall, and I'd seen him on the other side of the store. And so I walked up and introduced myself, and I said, you know, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said some things that were very offensive to a young black guy once, and I'm never going to have an opportunity to make that right. And I need to say to you that I regret doing that and apologize to him. And I stuck my hand out. Instead of taking my hand, he hugged me. And he hugged me in a way that I knew that he needed me to say that to him. So it's just that when you mentioned yesterday editing things, it was just a matter of doing the things that I was asked to do at that time, and it made a difference. So.
You don't know who you're going to set free. And sometimes proxy amends are less about you and more about the person who receives them. And a proxy amends is when you write a letter or you role play the amends for somebody that you can't find. You know, the book says that if there's a wrong that you can't set right, we write a letter, a heartfelt letter. But what we found and what we said is, like, you want to put it back out into the universe. So, Nan, you had to pay back that money. That money had to go into the universe. Well, in my learning, sometimes the energy, the love, and the healing needs to go back out into the universe. So we do these proxy amends. So I had a man in my home group who was a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just a great guy. But back in the day, apparently he wasn't very nice to some ladies. And he asked if he could read a proxy amends to me. And we were at a retreat almost exactly like this. You know, in my home group, we did the same thing. And so he caught me and he said, can you listen to this? And he read me this letter. And we kind of role played those three questions. And what happened was, and it was an incredible thing for the two of us. You know, I got to hear from him the things that my spirit needed to hear from the people who did some of the things to me that were not wonderful. And I needed that forgiveness and healing. And he needed to hear what I had to say because it gave him a deeper level of understanding of his wife. So by virtue of doing that proxy amends, both of us walked away having had a deeper understanding and experience with God. So yeah, you don't know. It could be that person in Walmart. It could be that person in your home group. I did a proxy amends in which I found out one of the people that was on my conduct inventory had slept with one of my sponsees. And I wouldn't have found out if I didn't do the proxy amends because of the fact that the person I did the proxy amends with told me. Now, think about when you're sitting doing a fist step and you realize that you shared the same man with somebody you're doing a fist step with. That's a very uncomfortable position to be in. Who? Did he have a freckle where? What's even more interesting is when it's a gay man you're doing a fist step with. That response would have been very different if I didn't find out through the proxy. But because I had to do this proxy amends for the person that I had harmed and I couldn't find him, God chose that person to tell me that the guy that I was doing the proxy amends for slept with the gay man that I was sponsoring. To find out that my ex was gay and cheating on me with my sponsee would have been very difficult to hear in the fifth step process. I was able to hear about it, call my sponsor, say, holy crap, what do you do with that one? Get some guidance, go to God, and come around, talk to the guy that I was sponsoring. Do the inventory process with him, and it was a really beautiful thing. And we ended up laughing about it. We're cackling like hyenas. So what would have been a very uncomfortable situation turned out to be a very beautiful one. But you wouldn't know. You don't know unless you listen to that vital sixth sense. We're almost done with this part of it. We have time for one quick. Gary, you wanna?
Okay, just quick. What about literally killing the person we harm, this guy? How do we make amends to that person?
I don't know. What do you think?
I know two instances. They're not mine.
Okay. Good one.
before I moved out here, I ran with a guy in AA, and we were making some early attempts to get through the steps. And in a drunken stupor one night, his baby died. And it was tragic. So here I was sitting with a man, and we're looking at the steps and trying to figure out, how do you make amends for that, and what do you do? So we went to a third man who said his best idea was for Bill to go home and write a letter to the baby. I'm not going to get through this. Telling that baby everything he ever wanted to tell his child. Everything he ever did want to tell. And he was told to write the letter, put it in an envelope, address the envelope to himself, put a stamp on it, and take it and put it in the mailbox. And a week or so later, I went to a meeting with Bill, and he says, I got my letter back. He says, I opened it up, and some of the words were changed. But he was free. My friend Earl, who helped me start this thing, when he was still drinking, he and his wife were separated. They had two boys. And of course, she had the boys. And they were separated for two reasons. One was his drinking, and the other one is she had slept with his best friend. And between the two, that's kind of hard on the marriage. And she had called him one day after they separated there and invited him to come over to the house. And so he goes over to the house. He rings the doorbell, and he hears a shotgun go off because she had blown her head off. And he, the problems with that went on for years, long after I met him and he was sober, where he was always a suspect for the killing of the wife's murder. He was dealing with that and trying to raise the boys and doing overall a pretty good job. One night in a meeting, he was trying to talk about that a little bit, and he got so angry at her for sleeping with his best friend. And so I sent him to the funeral, to the graveyard, and I said, "You got to find a way to get free of that. I think maybe you need to go to the cemetery and to her grave and tell her everything you ever wanted to tell her. I'm going to do that." And he called me late the next day and said he'd just gotten home from the night, and he had sat there at her grave for hours and cried. But he was free of it. He never once after that said anything about her or anything else, unless he was sharing with somebody else to be on that. But it freed him of the resentment and everything else that actually worked.
Thank you, Gary. That was beautiful.
I'm Karen, alcoholic.
Hi, Gary.
And when I first got in the program, I just had a real hatred for my father. It was like to the point of, okay, if he dies, let me know. Maybe I'll show up for the funeral. And blamed him for a whole lot of things. And we did do a lot of weird things when I was growing up, like burying gold and silver in the backyard in the middle of the night and having gun drills. And, I mean, it was just kind of a crazy childhood. But we'll jump up here. I was about 6 years sober and got to looking at things at from a different point of view. And eventually I came to the conclusion that, you know, my parents did the best that they could, and that I had really hurt them through the years because of not showing up at family functions, et cetera. So I was scheduled for back surgery about three, I'm 60 some years old. My parents are 88. My dad says, when you have your back surgery, he says, you're coming here to recover. He said, you have stairs at your house, now you just come home and let Mom and me take care of you. I thought it was just kind of weird when you're 60. But I did that. It was really good for them, and it was good for me. And it was the time where I could sit down at their kitchen table and make my amends to them. And Dad started to say, well, I haven't been. I said, you know what, Dad, this is about me making my amends to you for all how I have hurt you throughout the years. As a result of that now, my dad has opened up about a lot of things, and I understand him better.
Yeah.
Things he'd never told me before and probably never would have. And this summer will be the fourth generation vacation that my family has taken in southern Michigan. My siblings and I took my parents on a 7-day Southern Caribbean cruise for their 90th birthdays in January, and I have a beautiful relationship with them today. And I'm so grateful for that, and I'm so grateful that I don't have to make the graveyard amends.
Yeah. Yes. So the amends,
they can be beautiful, they can be wonderful. You can be told to F off. That's happened. I've been held hostage to somebody who in a men's process told me for 3 hours because they were in recovery. So when I made that phone call, they knew exactly what that was. So in the time in which I called to make the appointment and I showed up for the appointment, she sat, it was an old sponsee of mine, and made a list of everything I ever did ever that hurt her feelings. Think about how many times your sponsor has at times made you uncomfortable. And I sat for almost 3 hours, of which she then went down the laundry list of everything that I ever did, including the phone calls that I didn't return in a prompt or timely manner. You know, less than, I believe that if you return a phone call in 12 to 24 hours, that's an appropriate phone call unless it's an SOS, 911. Apparently that was not appropriate for her, and it was this list, and I sat there and I'm like, I didn't know what to do. I couldn't stop her. You don't do that. But I just kind of went to like this zen zone. I sat on my hands so I didn't respond because I wanted to defend, and I just sat there and I listened and I listened and I listened and I listened, and finally she was done. She read the list, and it was 3 hours. She's like, and at one point she was like, don't you have another question to ask me? I'm like, oh shit, I forgot that one. Like, seriously, because I'm sitting there, right? And, 3 hours. I walked out. I got to tell you what. That fear of, you know when you fear of, like, somebody doesn't share my reality, or if you say something mean to me, I'll break. That completely and totally went away. You know, like, I walked out of there, and I was like, I sat here for 3 hours and was told that I'm a terrible human being. And, like, this woman's crazy. Like, she really, like, she said, like, she would fire me and then get sponsored by my sponsor, and then she would fire my sponsor and go to his sponsor, and then she would go to his sponsor, and she'd keep going up the chain. And this is my amends was that, or that the issue was that I kept sponsoring her even after she kept doing this, because I kept thinking, this time it'll be different. I'll fix her. Went to Al-Anon, realized that I was crazy, and had to make an amends. So sometimes your amends aren't going to be like kumbaya. Sometimes it's going to be 3 hours of somebody sticking their fist up your ass. And that's okay. Because I walked out of there and I was like, you know what? One, I'll never sponsor one of those guys again. Two, I learned something about, and I had a surrender. I had a deep surrender. And it was, you know, I don't have to own your reality. You're allowed to have your reality. It doesn't have to agree with mine. I can sit here and you can tell me your feelings in regards to me, but I don't have to own them. And they don't have to change how I feel about myself. So I walked out of an amends that should have been extremely uncomfortable and very unpleasant. And guess what? She's my Facebook friend. She Facebook friended me and I was like, fuck it. What's she gonna do? But she's also no longer a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's okay. She'll come back when she's ready to come back, but you know what? My butt's still in this chair. And frankly, if I fire somebody and they hire my sponsor and then they fire my sponsor and hire my sponsor's sponsor, I tend to think, you know what? Keeping it in the family is not always the best idea. Maybe you might want to move along to one of the other families. And that was something I learned from it. And so let's take a break.